AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion. And by Hyundai. See what makes Elantra so nice. Check out its style, interior space, fuel economy, and popular features now.
This is AutoLine After Hours with Gary Vasilash, episode 260 for October 2nd, 2014. Studio 2000X, rendering the future of Ford design.
Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Good evening. For you guys, it's evening. For us guys here, it's afternoon. We're taping this in advance. John's not here. John's in Paris, which is why we're doing the show early. So don't send in your questions because we're not going to see them. And I do want to encourage you to, A, send in your questions next week when we'll be doing the show, and, B, watch John's reports from Paris. You can check them online at AutoLine.tv. So with that, I'd like to welcome our panel here. We have Jeff Sabatini from Car and Driver Magazine. Jeff, thanks. Good to see you again.
Good to be here. Been well.
You've been well?
I'm here.
Good. Good to see you. John Manoogian is back. He's with the College for Creative Studies.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. And our special guest this evening or this afternoon or however we want to play it is Jeff Nowak, who is chief designer of Ford Studio 2000X, which is clearly the most exotic name of a studio I'd ever
pretty
heard.
Impressive.
So tell us about what you do and how you do it.
So Studio 2000X is a supportive studio within Ford Motor Company reporting to design. We support all of the global studios around the world with high-end visualization of all of our vehicles at certain stages throughout the product development process. We do really high-end visualizations of those vehicles. We also support a lot of the training for our designers. We also support a lot of the technologies, all of the design technologies that are kind of coming to fruition, some of the newer technologies to be able to sculpt and design with new tools. And so we research those tools and bring those in and start to study how those would be used on the studio floor.
So you guys are like the tech guys?
We are a little bit, although we all come from an artistic background, so we all have a strong kind of affinity for the artistic pursuit. Mm-hmm. But we understand that technology plays a strong role in allowing us to do things, you know, in a more accelerated fashion. So we're constantly looking at new technologies to do that.
Mm-hmm. So if somebody's on a car program, they're designing something,
sure,
then they send it over to you guys?
Yeah, at a certain phase, and there's a couple of different phases throughout the process, we'll take some of those early design themes and actually give them kind of a level of life in an animation. So mm-hmm. we can actually take a look at very realistic materials, you know, the grains of the leathers, the different sheens of the paints. We can really kind of tune those surface attributes to really get a realistic feel for what the either interior or exterior is going to look like in a more finished trim, mm-hmm. without having to necessarily build a full-size physical property. Mm-hmm. So,
do you guys drop them into like realistic backgrounds and have the cars moving also?
We do, John. So we actually build out those environments as well. And so many times we're actually telling a story.
Exactly,
and
yes.
So we're taking that theme and we're trying to give it a life, not just of its shape and form, but also of its kind of culture, the
sure.
relevancy of a certain cultural backdrop. So we actually build those environments as well. And, you know, we also bring music to the table as well to kind of give it a certain drama. And all those elements together kind of tell a story. And
So what we're seeing here, is this real or is this what you guys did?
So this is a piece that we did for the new Edge. And there's no physical objects in any of this material. This is all rendered on high-end computers at Ford. What we call our render farm. We have an extremely large render farm that allows us to render out these really high-end animations. And so here you can see there's all kinds of interesting features like depth of field. We have all kinds of different lens flares and different elements to give kind of a certain production quality that we also like to achieve, to give our vehicles a level of cinematography and, mm-hmm. and realism. Here you can see some of the interior shots. And in the interior, you can actually see some of this, what we call depth of field, where we're actually going in and out of focus to kind of give focus literally to certain elements within the animation. So you can see kind of the blurring and the focus moving within the shot. It's a kind of a classic cinematography technique. And what's interesting is, you know, while this is all driven by computers, at the end of the day, it's a very artistic experience and driven through artistry. Mm. So it's really exciting space to be in, actually.
So when in a program, I mean, would this occur? I mean, so
something of this quality is occurring quite a bit later in the program, because as you can see, a lot of the details have been fleshed out. But, you know, an example like this would be perfect for doing like a color and materials study, where we might want to try different color breakups of the body, different color shifts in the body, different materials in the lower rocker area. We might want to study different kinds of headlamp designs. And so it's usually a little bit later in the program, but it really, as you can see, it's a very compelling kind of experience, so we can really make some pretty informed decisions based on those.
And good design always has to tell a story, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And it's easy to do exciting animations with really great designs. So, you know, you can't take a subpar design and make it, you know, excellent design out of utilizing animation. You have to have good foundations.
So have you had any examples where your studio got the property and you rendered it and the designer who was in charge of that looked at it and said, gee, I never realized it would look quite like that. I've got to change this surface.
I think there's a few items like that. I mean, animation allows you to look at a car in a different, lots of times in different viewpoints that maybe you might not see in a traditional, you know, standing height. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we might take a more creative position on how to shoot a certain camera scene. And so we might see something that normally you wouldn't see from a normal, you know, 6 foot or 5 foot five kind of position. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, something might come to light in that kind of interrogation. But at the end of the day, it's usually a very positive experience. Usually a lot of that kind of vetting of the design has already occurred on the studio floor. Mm-hmm. So generally we don't find too many surprises. But on rare occasion we have, and it's a great tool for finding those.
So you're essentially making little films.
That's right.
And is the intended audience for the film in some cases executives, board members? I mean, are these things that are being shown then to get buy-in from the finance guys and from, you know, other stakeholders in the company?
Yeah, great observation. So, yeah, these are really vignettes, like little mock-ups, basically, or shorts, to really make sure that our executive management team is comfortable with making the big signature on the end of the check, right? So, It is board direct. It's at the level of board of directors. It's at the level of our highest levels of product development management as well. And, you know, it really gives them a level of confidence. You know, they'll also have a clay model at that time. But sometimes the clay models don't quite have the same level of detailing. As you can see, these animations have all the stitches and all the details that we might not actually have even in our physical property at that point. So it gives an incremental level of confidence, I think, to our executives that it's the right product for the right time and the right place. So
John, given your experience as a designer, what was done before things like this?
Oh, you know, technology has come so far since I started in the business. But, you know, the reality of it is it's a great tool to visualize quickly a beautiful finished model. Mm-hmm. And prior to that, of course, still today, you build a full-size clay model, you dynock it, you make it shiny. Ultimately, you make a fiberglass or a foam model. It looks very realistic. The beauty about doing an animation is you get to see it in a normal driving environment, which you can't see when the car is just sitting as a clay model on the patio. Mm-hmm. So while you know, the two are great tools, I think together they work real well. Mm-hmm. One of the questions I wanted to ask Jeff about was the use of clay at Ford and how that plays into the technology with the kind of work that you're doing.
Yeah, so clay plays a huge role at Ford Design and will continue to play a huge role. In essence, this technology really isn't mutually exclusive to analog clay modeling. We really see them as a kind of synergy of two different functions, but very complementary functions. So we still see clay as definitely being kind of the physical expression of the design. We still have to mill out a clay model and really feel really confident about its proportions. Proportion is king. You have to kind of experience that full size. And animations just give it that extra layer of detailing, I think, that, again, allows people to feel really confident in the decisions moving forward. So we're really not a digital versus physical kind of company. It's really an all-inclusive philosophy of using the right tool at the right time in a complementary kind of mode. So I know there's been a lot of dialogues of that.
So you don't see clay going away anytime soon?
No, absolutely not. Now, it might trend towards more of a verification tool in the future, but even then, you know, you still have to have that physical
sure.
experience of maybe even touching the surfaces physically with your hands.
There's something to be said about the three-dimensional ability to touch something and feel the surfaces. I don't know. Maybe I'm all too old school, ability to touch and feel a surface, there's nothing quite like
that. There isn't. So, you know, there's always going to be that need.
But didn't it seem like 10 years ago that all the car companies were basically talking about how clay would go away?
General Motors.
Everything would be done with math.
Mm-hmm. And
you'd go into a room and put on a headset.
It was all going to be virtual.
It's all going to be virtual.
And that never happened.
There were a lot of really terrible-looking cars designed 10 years ago.
A lot of missteps along the way.
Okay, but is that because they were attempting to do it completely digitally, or was it just because they were just bad designs?
Yes, and yes.
Did they ever make a clay of the Chevy SSR?
Yes, they did.
That's an example.
Yes, they did.
At least that sticks out to me of like some of the problems of not having or of having too much digital. That car wound up coming off as very cartoonish and sort of missed the boat of what should have been a really great sort of early retro design, and it just flopped.
They had a full size clay of that.
Yeah,
I saw it.
Mm-hmm. Didn't help.
Didn't help. But, you know, there were other things involved with that car that maybe made it not quite as successful. And that was the fact that when you put the roof, the top down, the bed went away. Well, that just always seemed a little odd to me. But anyway.
So I think, you know, the reason that occurred is I think we lost sight of what the ultimate delivery is, and that's a beautiful car.
Exactly.
And everyone thought somehow process was the driver, and process should not necessarily ever be the driver. I mean, there's certainly cost saves associated with process, but at the end of the day, the product has to rule.
So in other words, the thought was that it would be more efficient to do it that way.
Absolutely.
And as a result of this pursuit of efficiency,
everybody kind of lost.
Aesthetic sort of was secondary.
I don't think anyone realized it, but that's essentially what was happening.
I don't think it was conscious.
No, it wasn't.
But you're absolutely right. Yeah. There was a feeling that we were going to become so much more efficient.
Yeah, right.
Rather than doing a program in 48 months, it was going to come down to 24 months. And everybody was excited about that, as they should be, because the faster you get to market, the better you are. The problem is, if you're fast to market with a piece of junk, no one cares how fast you did it.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things, so you mentioned offstage that you went to CCS.
I did.
And I wonder, with all of the technology that is used in your studio, I mean, how many people do you have there that are designers versus how many are basically, and I say this in a loving way, computer geeks?
So I would say about 50-50. So we've got like 10 extremely creative designer/animators, and we have 10 kind of a little bit more technically oriented people on the team as well. You still have to have technical people to kind of solve a lot of these issues of how to get data from point A to point B and all these items that just you can't avoid, right? But then we've also got this creative talent pool on the team as well that can really think in a more intuitive manner. And one thing I wanted to bring up is I think there are a lot of intuitive tools and modeling tools kind of evolving in the industry that are really going to allow us to work maybe more digitally, even in more of kind of a digital clay kind of fashion in the future. So I think there is going to be kind of bridging tools to...
Okay, digital clay. What is digital clay?
Digital clay, really, if you can kind of imagine models being made out of a series of little kind of what we call polygons, these digital models. These polygons are getting smaller and smaller to the point where we're actually able to sculpt 3D shapes and forms on the computer now with an actual pen, like a brush, essentially. So we're now kind of getting digital to become more analog. And I think there's going to be some really breakthrough technologies occurring in the next 5 years that are really going to allow us to, you know, work both physically and digitally, but in this more kind of intuitive artistry kind of format. So that's exciting for us. And we're
researching. Is this technology being developed for the auto industry, or is it being used in another industry that you guys are going to adapt it?
It's a great observation. It's really coming out of the media and entertainment, so really out of Hollywood. But there's some functions in the tools as they stand currently that don't really lend themselves to automotive. So we're actually working with some of those companies to try to bring those techniques into the fold and really start to develop tools that, again, are these more artistic-oriented tools.
Have you hired from the entertainment business at all?
We have. A lot of the animators on our team have worked on large productions, animated productions in Hollywood, and they come with a tremendous amount of experience. So we really almost have a small Hollywood animation studio. Mm-hmm. Basically,
so you could do a Michael Bay production, kind of.
Yeah, we could. So we're kind of doing that, essentially.
Right.
It's an exciting...
You have to blow up more cars.
Yeah, we have to blow up more cars.
Just show those beautiful things. They got to blow up. Right.
Those end up on the cutting room floor.
Turn them into robots and things like that.
I don't think they like to talk about engine fires at Ford.
That's true, but I mean, if it were really spectacular and, you know, this whole Michael Bay thing, that would... But, John, what does this do to the education of designers?
I still have my class, believe it or not, sketch with pen and paper. Mm-hmm. But... the digital part of it is certainly a major part of their education. They have to know how to use all the tools, but there's something to be said for using a piece of paper and a pen or a pencil to communicate an idea. So when they come to me, they're seniors. They've had all their background classes and their training in the digital part of it, but they've also had a lot of training in the analog part of it. And I want them to retain that because there's something to be said for the ability, as you well know, to sit down and draw and communicate with someone else real time. Mm-hmm. Here's what I think something wants to look like, whether it's a sculptor, whether it's someone in senior management, whether it's somebody from marketing, whomever, that ability is paramount in that process. So I sort of let them do both. It's been interesting because some of the students would rather not do a clay model for their final projects. They want to do a digital model. And I won't let them. I say, you know, that's fine when you become a professional. Mm-hmm. Guys like Jeff are going to be able to make your stuff look as shiny and beautiful as a real car. But I want you as a student to understand and have the ability to actually sculpt and mold your design in three dimensions with your hands. Mm-hmm. There's just... You can't replace that.
It's a primal thing.
It is.
You connect with the material, right?
It is.
And as soon as you disconnect that, you disconnect that seamless link between artistry and flow to the expression of the artistry. So,
and I think that's where goofy cars sometimes come from.
Yeah, I agree.
Is you lose that sense of design and passion, and it becomes just kind of a technological exercise.
Exactly. Again, losing sight of process versus end outcome. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so
the end outcome of digital is kind of different than the end outcome of real clay. I mean, if you're building a car to actually be used as a car as opposed to be used in a video game, I think there are other considerations. I thought it was very interesting when you said about, you know, seeing the car from different vantage points and different, you know, that you wouldn't normally see, you know, just standing there. That's pretty that's pretty neat when you think about it.
Mm-hmm. You know, a car should look beautiful up on the second story looking down, right? In reality, right?
Right.
We don't necessarily think about that all the time in when we're on the studio floor.
But it's also interesting, I mean, you're talking about looking at the car, you know, on the patio where, in case some of our viewers don't realize that all car design studios have an outdoor patio that they put these full-size
viewing
models
area,
on.
Yes.
And so they're able to walk around and look at it.
Correct.
But, you know, I've yet to hear a car designer say that they really have an appreciation or understanding of a design until it is out there with other cars. I mean, we all see cars at auto shows, and we have no real sense of perspective or dimension or how they would look until we see it on the road. And what you seem to be able to do is to more or less put it there.
Yeah, I think context is a huge part of what we do as well. I think John actually alluded to that. This clay model sitting in the studio is a very kind of abstract kind of view of the product. And until you can kind of get it in a real-world context, it really gives it such a different feel. And if you can put it in context of your competition, some of your competitive vehicles as well, I mean, there's another level of value there. But just putting it in a lively environment has a huge value, right? Mm-hmm. So those are really important observations.
And to that point, Gary, when you're working on a car physically in the studio, it's like working on a painting and you're this close to it for so long, you need to be able to step back and look at it like you see it on the street. Mm-hmm. And so I can tell you that there's a lot of surprises when you take the car the first time mm-hmm. from the studio outside and you're able to get back across from quite a distance and look at the vehicle. Suddenly things change mm-hmm. drastically, mm-hmm. sometimes for the worse, sometimes for the better. Mm-hmm. But when you're working on something and you're just too close to it for too long, you need this sense of being able to sort of stand back as you would see it on the street versus being up close to it like this. Because everybody's inclination, whenever you invite somebody into the studio, senior management, mm-hmm. the first thing they want to do is they want to walk right up to the car and get real close to it. And you tell them, stand back, you know, look at this thing from mm-hmm. how you would see it in a parking lot or driving down the street. You get a totally different feel for the car mm-hmm. when you're sort of right up like this versus like this.
So you guys can put it in the parking lot sure. and put it on the street.
Yeah,
and
he can have it driving down the street.
I was just going to say, so a vehicle in motion, these shapes in motion are another component to this. I mean, everything we see in the studio is static. So to be able
reflections,
to
get highlights.
How the reflections play on the surfaces, it's incredibly important. Mm-hmm. So it's important to see that as early as possible in the mm-hmm. product development process to really respond to it as quickly as possible. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
You know, we were talking about technology and developments in that space in terms of developing cars, and there's all this attention now for 3D printing. Do you guys get involved in that at all? Are you looking at that?
We are. We have a lot of 3D printing capability within design. It's still kind of isolated in a special department, but I think, you know, there's going to be a breakthrough where that technology probably finds its way into the studio at some point mm-hmm. and maybe becomes a output device for designers, literally. So it's not just this separate little environment where you have to submit a job, but it's actually maybe next to the designer's desk. So we're looking at those technologies and how they might apply at the studio floor level.
Hmm. Wouldn't that be a good technology for things like wheels?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, that
Absolutely.
To me is a perfect example.
Yeah, or any component.
Plus all the interior stuff.
Sure, all the components. With
headlamps,
interiors.
Tail lamps.
Exactly. Yeah. Right now, the limitations are really just in terms of the kind of the envelope of the object right now, but we're seeing those increase. We're also seeing the turnaround times on how big of a model you complete overnight is really increasing substantially. And so, you know, we're kind of imagining a time in the same way that we do renders overnight. Mm-hmm. While we're sleeping, the render farm's going. We actually imagine, you know, growing parts at night.
Right.
Coming in the morning and reviewing our designs in 3D. Mm-hmm. So physical representation. So we're excited
about that. The beauty of that, too, is like if you're doing a wheel, you can see what the backside is going to look like in a 3D model.
Absolutely.
When you do that in clay, you can't.
That's right.
So, I mean, that's been something that's really been great in that we used to do clay wheels where you'd just do the face of the wheel. You'd look at it on the car, it would look beautiful, whatever. But now with 3D printing, you can actually print that wheel and actually see what the backside is going to look like and the structure.
Sure.
Which is
very
a
important.
Great tool to have early on.
So would you allow your students ever to do their final project printing?
Someone brought that up recently, and I said, not yet.
That's an interesting... That's
Look, I know what Art Center that...
I know.
Okay.
Yeah.
But does it seem like a good idea? I mean, or is it, again,
it
there's something to the hand
but
that...
I before they get out into the real world, I want them to at least experience doing one clay model on their own and experiencing what that's like. Because once they become professionals, there are professional sculptors who are going to do that for them. But I want them to learn the respect for having a good sculptor, because a good sculptor can make or break your design. Mm-hmm. And I want them to be able to understand how important it is for them to be able to communicate in three dimensions with a sculptor. Here's what I want this surface to do. Here's how the sections want to look. And oftentimes, if they don't go through that experience, they don't understand what that sculptor is going to have to do to get to where they need to be. So, I mean, I
totally agree. I mean, I think that's a core foundation. You need to build on foundations in a college, right? And you can't skip those foundations.
And they may never use it again, ever.
Right, but right. They're powerful foundations in terms of communicating with the other team members. So, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I hope that doesn't go away anytime
soon.
I hope
not, too.
Probably at some point will be a day, but...
yes.
You know.
But why would that ever be? I mean...
Cape drawings have pretty much gone away. Do you guys still do them or not?
No, it's long gone.
BMW and Mercedes still do them, but a full-size tape drawing... It's taking a engineering drawing of the vehicle, which has the engine, seating position, the occupant... And then using black photographic tape in varying widths, you outline the vehicle in tape. And those tape drawings can be very, very sophisticated so that they look like pieces of art. Well, that technology kind of went away maybe, 10, 15 years ago?
At least 15 now, yeah.
And so when you talk to students about doing a tape drawing of their model in scale, most of them either don't want to do it or they just can't be bothered. But I think that's another tool where... You learn the sophistication of line.
Sure, proportion and acceleration.
Where you look at line and just subtle subtle changes in the way lines are with tape that you can't when you're doing a sketch like this. You can't make that leap from this sketch to something full size and understand what those lines and surfaces are going to do. So, but that technique is kind of gone now.
Are you still teaching that, John? I'm just curious. Tape drawing?
I have them do it.
Okay. Just
but
to kind of
they resist it. A lot of them don't like doing it, but
yeah.
I still force them to do it.
It's a part of learning line and shape.
Yes, yeah.
But isn't this a little like teaching someone how to write on typewriters?
No, because I think it's more like asking a carpenter, do you know how to use a saw and a hammer? Versus all the sophisticated tools that they have now. I mean, typing on a typewriter, the end result is still the same, I think, right? But a tape drawing, I think there's a level of learning that you go through on what your two-dimensional sketch looked like on paper or in the tube, and then converting that to a full-size.
I think there's a deeper learning in the doing, the physical doing of that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the muscle memory of doing that, and there's lots
sighting down the lines, looking
exactly.
At crown.
Exactly. So I think there's great value in it as well. Mm-hmm. I think there will be a day, right? Just like, you know, calculators came along and, you know, technology kind of lives on the shoulders of its predecessor. I think there will be a day, but, you know, I think those foundations are incredibly important. So
I'm
glad to see CCS is supporting all that.
We'll see.
So... Does your team accelerate the throughput of designs? Is it help get vehicles out on the street more quickly than if we were to go back 10, 15 years?
It does. It does that with a higher level of confidence, right? Because we have higher levels of fidelity to make really good decisions.
Mm-hmm.
In the past, there was a little bit of a kind of a gamble of, you know, I think this is good enough.
A leap of faith.
It was kind of a leap of faith, right? Now there's not really that leap. I mean, we have such beautiful illustrations understanding what that product is going to look like. We feel much more confident in our decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So that's an exciting development.
Mm-hmm.
And the technology is also an accelerator. So not only can it allow us to get to market faster, it might allow us to actually study more than one theme concurrently over a longer period to kind of vet that design process, right? So we might actually run more and more iterations through the same time frame to find the best design solution. Mm-hmm. So,
is Ford using your videos or movies or whatever you want to call them? Are they using those to clinic cars with for market research?
We have. We've done quite a bit of market research with animation as well. In all the global product development that we do, there's a big advantage of actually moving our animations. Rather than moving physical models all over the globe, we can kind of just move a thumb drive around to clinics. So there's some serious advantages to that in terms of turnaround and the response from our market research events globally. So currently, we're not doing a whole lot of that. We've done a lot of that in the past, but we're kind of looking at doing things in a slightly different way in the future. So we're kind of looking at kind of a new process in that space in the future that we can't really discuss at this point.
Mm-hmm. So. Intriguing?
Yeah.
Well, Jeff, with that, I think we'll wrap it up with you. And so I really want to thank you for being here this evening / afternoon.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Jeff Nowak, chief designer of Ford's Studio 2000X.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. And so now we're going to hear from Bridgestone Firestone.
There's only one car company in America that's never made a single car. And while you won't find Firestone cars on any showroom floor, they're out there, running better, faster, stronger, longer. No, we don't build cars. But make no mistake, Firestone is a car company. So whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
Okay, we're back with Jeff Sabatini, John Manoogian. And so I want to talk to you, Jeff, about what your take is about the big changes at Cadillac. We've got a new headquarters coming. We've got Johann Denischen telling the dealers that things are going to get worse before they get better. We've got a situation where Cadillac sales, now we don't know what the sales are going to be for this past month since we're the day before sales are out, but by the time people are seeing this, sales numbers will be out. But let's just say that Cadillac doesn't get much better, so they've got a sales problem there with some of the vehicles. And what else do we have?
New naming.
So what's your take on going to New York?
It's like the Muppets take Manhattan. I mean, it's just a terrible idea. I think that General Motors, they've got serious problems running Cadillac, but I don't think that that's going to be solved by setting up a new headquarters for a small group of people in a city that has almost no car culture and is only going to be a distraction. And I think it's pretty clear that this is the Denischen playbook that he used at Infiniti. He moved Infiniti's headquarters to Hong Kong. He decided he would rename all their vehicles Q with a number. And it looks like he's doing the exact same thing at Cadillac. I don't know that this is necessarily a good strategy. I don't think it's been working all that particularly well for Infiniti. And I just, as a lifelong Michigander and someone who's a student of history and loves the Cadillac brand, I just think this is a disaster in the making.
John, now, I understand that you got to be sensitive to talking about some of these things, given that you have lots of friends and,
yes,
and people at General
Motors. And they pay the bills where I work
And they pay the bills where you work right now. But let me ask you something. I mean, does geography play a big role in what can be created?
You know, that's an excellent question that I've pondered since I was a young designer. We always used to have debates about, can you be as creative in Toledo as you can in Southern California? I mean, when I look at the great designs that came out of Turin, and if you go to Turin, Italy, it's not the most impressive place on the planet, but they were producing some of the most iconic designs ever produced. Detroit certainly has produced some great designs over the past. So I'm not necessarily an advocate that you have to be where it's on the beach to design great cars. But having said that, I think maybe moving to New York, at least for the marketing, advertising part of it, might attract some people that probably might not want to move to Detroit. I mean, I'm a lifelong Michigander as well, but I think they're desperate to sort of move the needle, and I think whatever it takes, they're going to have to try something. Mm-hmm. I'm not in full agreement with the whole CT6 naming convention, but the move to New York, it's 50 people. You know, are they more creative there than they are here? I don't know that that's necessarily true either, mm-hmm. but it's a change of venue. Maybe they'll have a different perspective. I don't know how they're going to do the product development stuff, whether they're going to have to keep flying back and forth or not, because mm-hmm. everything is going to still be done here in Warren.
Right.
And at the Pruning Grounds.
Do you think they even know? I mean, that's...
Maybe they don't.
This whole thing is just... It's just a distraction. You know, it's like when your house needs maintenance, you don't go rent an apartment. You know, and I mean, that's what essentially they're doing, is running away from the problems that they have here in Detroit by going to New York. And the naming convention thing is just, it's so ridiculous.
Yeah.
Let's explain what this naming convention thing is. Okay, so they announced that their new luxury vehicle, their new top-end technology
flagship
vehicle will be called the CT6. And they're saying it's derived from Cadillac's use of CTS for its centerpiece car line. The name also indicates a coming shift to a simplified naming convention for future Cadillac models. Under this strategy, familiar lettering like CT would be used for car models, with the number indicating the relative size and position of the cars within the hierarchy of Cadillac models. Quote, as we expand the portfolio, we can assist consumers in placing the cars within a structure as they compare cars both within our showroom and across markets generally.
You've already been talking for way too long. I'm going to throw out a few words. Eldorado, Coupe de Ville, 60 Special.
Mirage. What a great name that
Cadillac
is.
Cadillac has so many great names that it already owns, and it's going off on this ridiculous Germanic alphanumeric scheme that's even worse than the current bad alphanumeric scheme it has. It's, you know, people respond to actual words, not codes and abbreviations.
And that gets back to this idea of story. There's got to be a good story. Design is about a story. And when you tell somebody, I got a new CZ10 versus an El Mirage, you know, I mean, one has a resonance to it that people can identify with. And the Germans own the alphanumeric naming strategy. I mean, there's no question of that. And they're good at it. Everybody sort of gets it. But to abandon that whole naming convention of having these names that evoke places or events or even made-up names, to me, resonates with consumers better than A, B.
And the other thing, and this is, I think, one of the fundamental problems with Cadillac right now, is they're trying to show that they can build as good a cars as the Germans, but have some sort of, you know, difference, some unique selling point. And one of the unique selling points that Cadillac has is its history, a better history than any other mark extant.
And standard of the world.
But you can't look back. You have to live in the future. You have to say to yourself, okay, what we did 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago worked then. It's not working today. But I would argue that that rich history should play some part of where they're going, but they need to sort of get a handle on the luxury market. I mean, everybody's getting jammed up in that whole high-end, top-of-the-market thing. And you really have to understand what people's wants and needs and desires are. It's more than just the hardware. They have the hardware right now. To me, they're building the best cars they have ever built, period. So what is it then?
We put the CTS on our 10 best list last year.
What is it? I mean, they have the hardware, right? It's there. What's stopping people from purchasing those cars? Because the hardware is already there.
Well, maybe recalling twice as many cars in a single year as the entire industry sells.
Yeah.
I mean, that...
That's not helping.
Being being part of the larger GM, I mean, the one thing about this whole decision that I agree with is giving Cadillac more autonomy outside of GM, but sending 50 people to Manhattan to work in a loft, that's not the problem.
So what is the problem?
Where do we go? I mean, a history of mismanagement at General Motors stretches back to before the bankruptcy.
So it isn't the name thing. I mean, they could, you know, I mean, you're talking about the future. They could call it like Alpha Prime Plus. And, you know, I mean, and if it's a crap car, it's a crap car. And if it's a great car,
if the product's good enough, they'll gravitate to it.
They'll get it regardless of what it's called.
I think there's been a revolving door at the top of Cadillac, and that door.
That doesn't help.
No, but it may be because it's a thankless position to be in and because it's not selling. I mean, so I was in Germany last week on vacation and you know, it occurred to me that, you know, we perceive Mercedes in the United States as being luxury cars, and yet
taxi cabs
are E-classes. And so I began to wonder, you know, just think about this for a minute, that you have this situation where presumably Cadillac would like to beat Mercedes, right? I mean, wouldn't that be a mantra that you might have? But you think about it, that in Germany, Mercedes is Cadillac and Chevrolet, right? Mm-hmm. And in the United States, Cadillac is Cadillac and Chevrolet is Chevrolet. And therefore, you don't have the scale, you don't have the volume, you don't have the bandwidth that they do there in order to be able to create S-classes probably at a better return.
But I think Germans are probably more nationalistic towards their own brands than Americans are towards American brands. I mean,
and let's not forget, 15 years ago, you know, it's Cadillac and Lincoln duking it out for the, you know, top luxury market in the United States. So this isn't like something all of a sudden, you know, this is fairly recent history. Cadillac was still a major player, and they need to stop trying to imitate the Germans.
Right.
They need to achieve product parity, which they have, but they need to take that next step to figure out what's our unique selling proposition. And I think ultimately, and I'm not one of these sort of, you got to have a corporate mission or a North Star, but really Cadillac needs to figure out what it really stands for and what it's going to do to give people a reason to buy it other than just be, we're as good as the Germans. And all this stuff that they're talking about right now just sounds like more, let's imitate the Germans. Let's go to New York to learn about luxury. If you've got to go to New York to learn about luxury, you're never going to, I mean, you've already failed.
And why not Beijing or Shanghai? I mean, if we're talking luxury, right?
That's, well, why not just stay here and do your job?
Well,
you know,
there is that. Well, okay, so you brought up Lincoln. So earlier this week, the Ford executives had an investor day when they told the investors what they would be doing, what their plans are, and you know, the top line on that was to say that blah 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 blah. Ford expects that by 2020, its annual global sales will increase by 45 to 55% to approximately 9.4 million. Very optimistic. And then,
wow.
I thought that was...
That's a big number.
It's a big number. And then, so you know that these financial things where they have to have that fine print back there. And in the fine print is absolutely hilarious. So the risk factors, so I'll just read some of the top risk factors. Decline in industry sales volume, particularly in the United States or Europe, due to financial crisis, recession, geopolitical events, or other factors. Decline in Ford's market share or failure to achieve growth. Let's see. So they won't achieve growth
if they
don't achieve growth. Lower than anticipated market acceptance of Ford's newer existing products. Market shift away from sales of larger, more profitable vehicles beyond Ford's current planning assumption, particularly in the United States. An increase in or continued volatility of fuel prices or reduced availability of fuel. I mean, it's just like beginning to sound like...
It sounds like the small print should have been the large print, and the large print should have been the small print.
Yeah, all the caveats are...
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy, but, okay.
The caveats are a description of the world we live in,
yes.
Whereas the text of that is a description of the fantasies
they have
in Dearborn.
So Lincoln. So, you know, Mark Fields came out very strongly and said... You know, we're backing Lincoln. Lincoln is important. We want Ford customers to have some place to go when they want something greater. And by 2020, Lincoln will be more solidly positioned. What do you think?
I mean, it's, There's just so many things I could say about that. I mean, you know, for the fact that they, the fact that they're Ford customers tells me they don't have, they don't need a place to go. I mean, I, the Ford has been such a one-trick pony for the past 15 years. With the Lincoln is a non-starter. I mean, I think that there's no hope for the Lincoln brand.
Just give up on it?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not an executive, but I keep driving every new Lincoln product and every single generation. I mean, it's been 10 years now. We've been told new Lincoln product is going to be, it's going to be, this is the new Lincoln. And it's just another Ford with just enough changes to it to try to trick people in the showroom. Lincoln is the most cynical brand in the entire auto industry. The lack of respect for the Lincoln customer from the Ford Motor Company is unbelievable to me.
And with, just, that, with that, we'll have the final word on that
subject. Over here
and
we're going to
take a commercial break now and hear from our friends at Hyundai.
Nice. Not nice.
The new Elantra from Hyundai. Nice.
You already know that you can listen to Autoline's Industry Insight in places like YouTube and Stitcher, but did you know that you can also listen to it live in your car? It's simple. Just pair your smartphone with your vehicle's Bluetooth connection or plug into the aux jack. Then navigate to Autoline.tv using your phone's browser. Find the show you want to hear and click play just like you would on your computer.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy.
It's that easy. Never be disconnected from Autoline's top-notch insider information with Autoline on the go.
Okay, we're back. And so, Jeff, the F-150, the drive program for the journalists is going on as we speak.
I am not on it.
And you're not on it, and I will be on it later this week. And Mustang is basically out in the real world. So
I've driven it, both of them.
You've driven both of them, and I know you've written extensively about the Mustang.
Boost. Yeah.
So
the new Mustang's great. We had the both versions through our office recently, and you know, there's still some question about the EcoBoost version. We only got an automatic, which wasn't necessarily our top choice, but boy, the V8 with the manual transmission, amazing car. Mm-hmm. Independent rear suspension has really transformed that vehicle.
Mm-hmm.
Its handling is excellent. Its interior is such a cut above everything else in the class now. And I mean, even the refreshed Challenger, which we also had at our office this last couple weeks, and the Mustang just blows everything away.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about the design of the new Mustang, Jen?
I like it. The first one I saw on the street actually was last week, and I saw it from rear three-quarter. I thought it was very nice. I mean, it's not earth-shaking, but it certainly looks like a Mustang, and it looks new. Those are my two criteria for any new car.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they did a good job on it.
It has the interesting effect of when you see it parked in a parking lot or, you know, driving by, you don't actually realize it's a new Mustang. It just looks like a Mustang. I mean, it's got that from a distance.
Taillights and yeah.
From a distance, it's a Mustang. But then when you get closer to it, all of a sudden you're like, whoa. And it pulls you in because you've got to see all the surfaces. It's so much more complex of a design than we've seen on a Mustang in years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's good.
It'll be interesting when the new Camaro comes out. Then you'll have a real duke out.
So, okay, might one say that this is really a Detroit obsessive phenomenon, which is why it's good to move to New York, because like people in Detroit and maybe Southern California care about things like Camaros and Mustangs, and the rest of the world doesn't.
I was reading a British magazine yesterday, and there was a letter to the editor about the Mustang being a global car now, and this particular writer said the Mustangs look, to use his terms, naff on British roads, meaning kind of wacky, just like oftentimes British cars used to look weird here in America. So his question was, you know, the Mustang is supposed to be this new global Mustang design, but will it resonate with Europeans and Asians? And I guess I don't know the answer to that question, but is that car going to be appropriate in those markets. I guess I just don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the thing is that it will become an affordable exotic car for Europeans. I mean, that's the way I look at it. Because
exotic meaning American?
Exotic meaning something that you don't see every day.
Right.
Exotic meaning special. Exotic meaning high performance. I mean, and I think them selling the car with a right-hand drive version and selling it in Europe for the first time officially, I think that's a good move for Ford, for the brand. I mean, that's their halo car. And if the company is a global company, they should sell their halo car globally, you know? And I think that the real trouble that you get into with that car is that it's never going to be a high-volume product. It's not their F-150. You know, it's not the car that they sell 700,000 of. Mm-hmm. So
speaking of which, I mean, the F-150, which, you know, we've talked about on the show many times, and you guys have talked about it, I'm sure, and the big risk about this all-aluminum vehicle and so on and so forth. And what I find to be very interesting is that Chrysler or Ram is really seems to be throwing down to Ford in a way that they've never had this opportunity to do before, and making the announcement today that 20% of the production of the Ram 1500 will have the diesel engine in it, and which makes them the only light-duty truck that's sold in the United States having a diesel engine. And they made the point that nearly 60% of their Ram 1500 Eco diesel sales are conquest.
Wow. Has Ford announced mileage figures for the truck yet or not yet?
I don't think they have they?
No?
I'm not aware of them. Mm-hmm. Ford's been not announcing a lot of things until the last minute with a lot of their new product launches, so that wouldn't surprise me.
And so for the Eco diesel, they're saying 28 miles per gallon highway for that truck. But but it's sort of interesting that, you know, if we think about trucks as tools, as things that people work with, it almost seems sensible that you would have a diesel offering in that space. And
I think the thing is that space has changed a lot. That space used to be very cost conscious. And so there was a lot of reticence on the part of the manufacturers to put a diesel in that class because they have to charge more for it. But now trucks have become much more expensive in general. The whole notion of a $50,000 F-150 is, you know, people pay that much for F-150s
right
now. So
it's the starter model.
Well, I mean, it's the prices of trucks have escalated, and I think that's allowed a company like Chrysler to go in and say, okay, what's the premium on it? Isn't it like a $4,000 premium or something to get the diesel?
For the diesel? Yeah. It is a few grand, yeah.
And so, but it's easier to absorb that in a more expensive, if your price points are stretching. And I think the thing that Chrysler is doing really smart is that they've realized that they've always been third, right? So they're not going after Chevy and GMC to try to get into second place. They're going right at Ford. They're trying to figure out how to leapfrog GM and really try to compare them, comparing themselves with F-150 on mileage. You know, it's a good strategy. Always compare yourself to the guy who's
best in the class,
the winner. And the new Ram is a really great pickup truck. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's got a lot of, they've done a lot of things that have taken risks. You know, coil springs instead of leaf springs. They've got that goofy rotary shift knob, which, as goofy as it is, it's a conversation piece.
And
people are attracted.
It's an 8-speed transmission,
yeah,
which you can't get from the other guys, which is.
And even their base V6 model, which is the minivan motor, the Pentastar V6, I mean, it gets pretty good fuel economy for what it is. Mm-hmm. And they've really, taken it to, their competition by really stressing that entry-level model. And then the new diesel, that just, you know, extends that fuel economy message.
Mm-hmm. Since we haven't talked about GM quite enough on this show... So Time Magazine put Mary Barra on the cover of Time Magazine, and in the history of Time Magazine, this is the 13th General Motors cover.
13th?
13th. And the very first general. So there were two covers that had illustrations, not people, okay? And so this makes her one of a select few. The first time was in January 1933, and they had Charles Kettering on the cover of Time magazine.
Kettering, not Sloan. Okay.
Sloan was on the cover in September 45.
Okay.
But between Kettering and Sloan was 1937 with William Knudsen. There was...
Was Harley Earl ever on the cover?
Harley Earl was never on the cover. Charles Wilson made it twice. He made it because he was the
Charles Engine, yeah.
Head of General Motors. That was in 49, and then in 1953 he became the Secretary of Defense when he made the famous comment about, you know, what's good for the country is good for General Motors and vice versa.
Yeah.
And then there was another guy who was on twice, was a guy, and I didn't know this guy. Okay, maybe you guys do. Harlow Curtis?
Sure.
Curtis, you know this guy?
Buick, yeah. And then he became chairman.
And he was named Man of the Year in 1956. So,
wow.
So did you ever hear this guy?
Yeah.
Yeah?
He was in charge of Buick for many years.
I was astonished. I mean, so I had to look this guy up.
When's the last one, though? Like, let's most recent one before
Okay,
Mary
the most
Bear.
Recent one before Mary Bear was May 1966, James Roche.
66?
He was the president in 1966. He became the CEO in 1967.
Wow.
And this was an interesting thing, and this is from General Motors, quote, and this is about James Roche, quote, his long association with the sales end of the automotive business gave him a keen understanding of the customer's desires and the firm belief that maximum customer satisfaction and product quality must be achieved in every phase of GM's operations. So it sounds like...
There you have it.
Sounds like this is all the stuff that we sort of been talking around and about.
That was in 1966.
1966, yeah. And then, so that was the last time there was a person on the cover. But, so why Mary Barra?
I don't know. Does anyone even care what's on the cover of Time magazine anymore? I mean, that to me, when you brought this up before the show, I mean, I was kind of like, Time magazine? I mean... You know, I don't feel like it has this cultural significance that maybe it did in 1966, but I think probably because this is sort of GM is a hot button topic because of, you know, still because of the bankruptcy and the whole bailout government motors, yada, 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 all that garbage. But also because the recall thing is arguably, you could make a case that's the news story of the year. And it's not just GM's recalls, but I mean the number of automotive recalls this year is completely insane from all car companies. And she's a woman, and I think that that's significant. Certainly, in a somewhat conservative, you know, old line company like General Motors, that she's female, so.
Any perspective, John?
Well, I think the pressure's on her, obviously, to make something happen. And it's got to happen today, not tomorrow. I mean,
right. She's
really got to make something happen.
Mm-hmm.
And the more things I read recently about her is she's come to the realization that is, in fact, the case, that she can't do this gradually, slowly, methodically. It's got to happen quickly. Otherwise, who knows what will happen.
But I mean, it's certainly a giant boat that must be turned.
Yes.
Which I thought was funny. Another person that was on the cover of Time magazine, which was really probably more relevant in 62 than 66, was Frederick Doner, who was the chairman.
Donner.
And it said on
Finance
the cover
committee.
Of Time, world's biggest manufacturer.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and so it's sort of interesting that now we're looking sort of at a manufacturer that isn't doing so well when back in these days that these people were all being revered.
Well, but the whole car business, I mean, that was back then. Today it's Apple. Today it's electronics. Today it's all about devices. Not
digital technology.
Cars are like, you know, general population. Do they care anymore? I don't know.
But
and to Jeff's point, you know, being on the cover of Time magazine, does anybody read it anymore? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You tell me. I don't know.
Apparently not.
The thing about GM is that I think it's pretty significant that the last time they had a CEO or chairman or whatever, the last GM executive that was on the cover was in 1966. Wasn't that the high point for GM market share in the United States?
Sure was about that time, yes. Late 60s.
Well, and I think it's one of the great tragedies of this industry, and it's not just GM's fault, but that this industry in total has allowed consumer consciousness and awareness and excitement for its products, which are still the most complicated consumer product you can buy.
Yes.
The greatest feat of engineering that we've developed to sell to someone, that we as an industry have let that enthusiasm just kind of be misplaced by,
yep,
you know, phones.
Yeah, it's interesting. So to the point of the high watermark, so it says that when Curtiss retired, and he retired in 1958, that General Motors sold approximately 60% of all the cars and trucks in the United States.
Isn't that something? What are they down to now, 17%?
They're below 20.
I think it's 17 or 18.
I don't like to even look at those numbers.
No, I don't either.
They're just...
It's depressing.
It is.
It's depressing.
So what else we got? You drive anything recently interesting?
No. Tomorrow I'm driving the BMW i8, though.
Yeah?
And actually, one of the things that I thought was thinking about that car, so it showed up at our office, and this is one of these cars that, you know, it looks like... It looks like it might only exist digitally because it's so out there and so wild.
Did you try getting in and out of it?
Carbon fiber. No, I won't get to drive it till tomorrow. But so it's finally parked at our office amidst all kinds of other new cars. And, I mean, you just want to go over and touch it. And you really want to touch it because it's got all these surfaces and this sort of, you know,
very
aerodynamic
complex
wing,
yes,
thing,
yeah,
on the back, yes, hatch. And, I mean, it's just an amazing-looking car. And, you know, you would never get the sense of that car from looking. I mean, I've looked at hundreds of pictures of it already, but you'll never get the sense of that car until it's actually parked there. And you could see it's so much smaller than you'd think it was.
It's a media event just getting in and out of it. But once you're in it, I mean, it's really cool. I had an opportunity to sit in one, and it's so cool. It's the future. But it was getting in and out of it that was difficult at best.
So in the future, it'll be more difficult to get in and out.
Well, that particular car.
It's always been difficult to get in and out of sports cars.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll look forward to discovering what your impressions of driving the i8 will be at some point here, Jeff. So
that'd be great. I'd love to come back.
So Jeff Sabatini, Car and Driver, and you can actually buy this physical magazine. It's called Car and Driver. It's not like Time. It's still very important.
Unlike Time, it is very important when it's on the cover of Car and Driver.
And whatever, and
usually red cars, though, right?
It's usually red Corvettes, Mustangs, and Camaros.
Something red.
There you go. Detroit-centric. So, okay, we'll let that go. John Manoogian.
Thanks for having me again. Yeah. It's always a pleasure.
Creative Studies, and
thank you.
Clearly a guy who knows what's going on in this industry very well. So, okay, now don't forget, John, who's not here, this right now for us is not Thursday, but he's in Paris. You can get his coverage at autoline.tv. That's autoline.tv. There'll be a ton of first looks at what's going on. I saw this list of interviews that they're going to be having. It's rather extensive. They're going to be talking to newsmakers. They're going to have new vehicle reveals. So that's autoline.tv. Friend Autoline at facebook.com/AutolineNetwork. Follow Autoline at Twitter at twitter.com/Autoline. And thank you all for watching us, and come back next week.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, your journey, our passion, and by Hyundai. See what makes Elantra so nice. Check out its style, interior space, fuel economy, and popular features now.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern, Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline this week. There is all that and much more at autoline.tv.